everyone. My name is Joshua Gilliland with the Founding Attorneys on the Legal Geeks. I am here at Oryx Silicon Valley office with Monty Cooper to talk about his granduncle, Marion Cooper. Monty, how are you today?
Just great. I'm delighted you are able to see the beauty of Silicon Valley without windows.
it's a magical place where litigation strategy and war rooms and discovery plans are put together and meet and confers. A lot of magic happens here. So could you tell our audience, what's your practice area?
I practice, as a lot of people in Silicon Valley do, in intellectual property. That is my specialty, primarily in patent litigation. But it crosses into copyright, trade secret, not so often trademark, but sometimes, but in related areas like cybersecurity.
Yeah, a lot there. And I know those cases usually from the discovery context because those tend to be heavy discovery cases. So that's how I sometimes learn about them or participate. You are a titan of geekdom in your own right. You presented with us at WonderCon. You went with us a couple years ago to San Diego Comic-Con, and you went out drinking with Ed Brubaker.
I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah, but it's just, you're geek cred with that. It's like, dude, awesome. What are some of your fandoms that you love?
Oh, I like a lot. As we're here to talk about Marion, it goes mm-hmm. back to my very long way. I've been a fan of movies in particular, speculative fiction, and its crossovers into sci-fi and fantasy films, in particular both television and film, all the way back to the point that I feel very proud to say, as a three-year-old, in 1967, my parents were delighted and amused by the fact that at that age, my two favorite films were the original Batman television series and Star Trek when it was still on CBS. As a three-year-old, I would actually ask my mom every day, she said, is Star Trek on tonight? Because, you know, I didn't grasp the idea that it was once a week. But I actually was crushed when my parents explained to me it was going off the air as a, you know, formative young kid. That was, like, traumatic.
So you have a couple years on me, because my childhood intersected with the Star Trek animated series.
Oh.
and I was like a year when that started. But I very remember on my fourth birthday, it was either my fourth birthday that Battlestar Galactica premiered, and on my fifth birthday, Star Blazers premiered. So that was everything a growing boy could want just from a fandom, you know, perspective. But I get it. I mean, I grew up watching Star Trek in syndication and being able to see it nightly on in the Bay Area Channel 2. It was like dinner time it would be on. So I get it.
Well, it's funny you should say that because, my parents really encouraged the exploration of these. And they were very permissive, I guess, in this sense. Very early on, they allowed me to see movies that most parents, even to this day, would be probably very restrictive about children under the age of 12 even seeing. Uh-huh. I recall loving the original time in 1971 seeing The French Connection.
Okay.
You know, as a kid, that chase scene is every bit as fantastic as it is to an adult. And maybe I didn't grasp some of the some of the racial elements or the drug qualities, but to me it was a exciting movie. One of the very first films that I know I saw as an R-rated film was The Omen in the early 70s. And then the very first film that I know I was permitted to go to on my own, even though I wasn't 17 yet, was the original Alien.
Wow.
My parents were understood that they felt I was adult enough to see it. And sure enough, ironically, one of the original Cooper Theaters, they did not card me. And, you know, I'm admitting to my formative juvenile delinquency, but I did get, that was the sort of movie that appealed to me at that time.
So my mother saw The Exorcist while pregnant with me, and
okay, that might not have been the healthiest.
You know, there were actually warning labels not to go do that, so that could explain how I turned out. But I, she was, her and my aunt were both good sci-fi fans. My mom also pretty healthy horror fan, not gratuitous stuff like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I mean again. Went to go see The Exorcist while pregnant, and that kind of sums up. She was into ghost stories, and she dutifully took me to go see Empire Strikes Back when I was 5. And so I do have that family experience with parents who were really supportive.
Yeah, and my parents were very protective. They wouldn't have let me see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, God.
They understood the distinction. Yeah. Where art crosses into the realm of sci-fi or fantasy as opposed to just, you know, revulsion.
Yes, slasher movies, exactly. You know, blood for the sake of blood. Yeah, it's just, some people love that. Power to them. Not my bag.
Not mine either.
But good sci-fi, good space adventure, 2001 to... never really got into Silent Runnings, but I appreciate it. And but that's just what you get with geeks, that there's a lot there and a lot we can appreciate. So you're the grandnephew of Marion Cooper, who did a lot, and could you tell us a little bit about, like, if you met him and what his legacy was within your family?
I did meet him. I don't have very strong memories because it was in the 60s.
Okay.
speaking of early formative movie-going iconography, in the late 60s, I think about 1969, after he had been diagnosed already with cancer, we made a trip to California in a car. And in a, you know, station wagon, late 60s model. Yeah. We headed out to Southern California. And what I have partial memories. I was so young that it's, looking back in the prism of time, it's hard for me to recall very much. I do remember, though, that I was in love with my my toy mock-up of the James Bond Goldfinger car, you know, with the ejection seat and everything.
Everything a kid could want, yeah, totally.
You know, and it's very vague. I know we met him in Southern California. I've heard I understood, and my memory is that it was San Diego, which is where I know he lived, but my parents seem to think it was actually in Santa Monica, which is not out of the realm of possibility either.
Yeah, a couple hours away. Yeah.
And my biggest memory about it is, you know, I was 3 or 4 years old, and I was insanely jealous that my sister had found a starfish on the beach outside their house. And that's, despite remembering that I was meeting a family relative, my fixation was on that she had a starfish and I didn't. I don't know how Marion reacted to that. But
that's like normal for a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old. That's a normal kid response. And again, meeting family members, you're meeting family members. And a little kid, that's a completely natural response to that situation.
It was. But I do regret that I can't recall more. I mean, for one thing, a long time my parents said I saw... He did, Marion late in his career in like 1952 was awarded an honorary Academy Award. According to my parents, I saw it, but if I did, I have zero memory of it.
Yeah, I'm familiar with this phenomenon. I had a grandaunt who died before I was born who was Walt Disney's secretary. And I've only known the legend of Aunt Polly. I didn't know Aunt Polly. So, you know, like I've heard grandparents or my dad talk about how she would bring home like 16mm Disney movies and they would watch them. And I actually chatted with a gentleman, Floyd Norman, from Disney fame, and he confirmed that. Like, yeah, we did that. So it's like, okay, validation that the family legend is true. But when you're dealing with someone like you haven't met, or you only like, yeah, I was 3 and have no memory of them, it's really hard to know fact from legend.
Well, fortunately, Well, I can't remember these events. You asked also it, how well it was known. Marion, you know, you, when you have a Hollywood director in the family, you do tend to get a lot of information about it digested through all sorts of family and out of family sources. And certain of my other relatives had, for independent reasons, achieved certain level of, I hate to use the word, but fame. My grandfather, who was Marion's brother, obviously, independently has a wealth of information about him, and was a pioneer in air law and space law, and even has a crater on the moon named after him.
Yeah, yeah, most families don't have that.
I can't see it. It's on the dark side.
But it's there.
On Wikipedia, they show it to you. Yeah.
It's like, that would be neat to go see someday.
Yeah.
I hope we can do that, but it's... Like, that's phenomenal.
Yeah, and meanwhile, my aunt, you know, his niece, became a very famous poet, published in the New Yorker, the Poet Laureate of New York at one point, and a professor of literature at Sarah Lawrence College. And she wrote an essay about King Kong. Is part of her vernacular, King Kong is my uncle, or my... uncle or something like that. It's a piece that she wrote. So those are the sort of infusings that you do get. And over time, you know, I'm now in my 50s. There's sort of a library of information. I hope most of it is accurate, but through the prism of family legend, you always wonder.
Yeah, you find out some things like, oh, that's not quite what happened. Or yeah, that sounds super heroic and... Did he really do that?
Exactly.
It leaves you wondering. It's like, it could have happened.
But yeah, my great uncle, you know, he was born over 100 years ago. So there is historical gaps in there.
Yeah.
And I what I know, I know as much as anything from official biographers, to be honest. So.
And that... Again, passage of time, generations, I mean, that's completely understandable. So, are you familiar with his inspiration to make King Kong?
Yes, I am. That part I think I do know, because I've heard it independently through the family long before I read segments of it in other sources. I'm going to ask that you go back and know something about my father's side of the family.
Okay.
It's kind of fun. I have the classic American mixture. My mother's side is classic near generation Irish. Her maiden name is Horrigan, County Cork and Kerry, you know, okay. within the 20th century. And she came from New England.
Okay.
My father, classic American on the other side, opposite the track, is the genteel southern or aristocracy side that goes back to something like 1720, maybe even earlier.
Wow.
And this is formative to understand Marion. The family's roots go back to southern Georgia and northern Florida, to the Revolutionary War, where, and this was very important to Marion, I think you have to add like 6 to 7 greats in front of grandfather, but he is a direct grandfather, was Colonel John Cooper, who is a Revolutionary War hero who rode and was the chief of staff or one of the people who fought with Pulaski, including at the Battle of Savannah, and he is the one who carried him off the field.
Wow.
Marion was very affected by that historical background. That, you know, again, the carrying off the field, you wonder if that's the legend. The fact of the matter is I do know my 6-7 great-grandfathers ahead of me. Definitely was a Revolutionary War hero because there are signs, I've seen them in Georgia that say this is the Battle of X where Colonel Cooper was injured or whatever. And so I know he was at Savannah and I know he had that background. And you have to go forward to Marion in the early 20th century. Both he and my grandfather entered Annapolis.
Okay.
And then my great grandfather was a prominent lawyer in Jacksonville. In fact, I am like 6th generation or 5th generation lawyer. The lawyers in my family go back to pre-Civil War.
Wow.
And they were very active in the Jacksonville community in the early 20th century. And Marion gets kicked out of Annapolis. So,
what year was he there?
Or he was there around 1909 or I want to say like 1913, very close in time to World War I, because that would. Now here's the prism of legend and family. If you go on to any official biographies, including what you can get in DVDs and that, you'll hear that the reason that Marion was kicked out of Annapolis was because he was vocal about wanting to see the Navy become more involved with air attack. We were less than 15 years from the Wright brothers at that point.
And yeah.
He was already espousing air delivery systems. I believe that's true, but this is the family story that I have never seen in the biographies. What I was told is that Marion was something of a hellraiser. And one of the mistakes he made at Annapolis is he got the grand idea to copy a test by using the white dungarees and sitting on the Xerox copy of the test and sitting on it, and they got caught. And that was amongst the reasons they were thrown out of Annapolis. I have later heard that Marion did concede there may have been more to his departure than just the air issue, which makes me think this might be where legend isn't legend. But and one way or another, he was kicked out.
Okay. Because that's an interesting time period, because when Theodore Roosevelt was president, he changed the way that people were promoted, so it was no longer based upon seniority, but merit. And that allowed people who were competent to get promoted. And the class that started when he was president, included Nimitz and Halsey, those who would go on and save the country during World War II. It sounds like they overlapped, or at least the latter half of that, into the Taft administration.
Let's try the Wilson, because this part I do know is true. My grandfather was actually a delegate to Woodrow Wilson nomination delegation in 1916.
Okay.
I believe it's fair to say at that point my family in northern Florida and Jacksonville was becoming active in Democratic politics.
Okay.
What happens, though, and this is where, to go back to your question, because you asked me the impetus for King Kong, and this is where things get fun. Marion lived a life that would actually make for a phenomenal Hollywood movie in its own right, and he has been compared in some biographies to a real-life Indiana Jones. What happens immediately after his expulsion from Annapolis becomes a magnificent story. He immediately wanted to get involved with the Georgia National Guard, and he did so and became part of the team that initially went into Mexico after Pancho Villa.
Wow.
Then World War II breaks out World War I had broken out, and in 1917, obviously, the United States enters it. He entered the war as he took classes to be a pilot and entered the war as a bombardier. And he was shot down by the Germans after about to bail out. His co-pilot was shot in the neck, and he was shot in the arm. And rather than doom his tail pilot to a certain death, he actually landed the plane and was spotted by the Germans, who took him into custody, and he remained a POW throughout the remainder of the war. But that act, the Germans did save his tail pilot's life. After the war, and this is where it really gets fascinating and why I started with Pulaski, he doesn't go back to the United States. He decided to actually stay in the nascent Poland that was involved after the Treaty of Versailles. And the Soviet-Bolshevik Polish War breaks out in 1919 and through 1921. Marion is one of the original creators of the Kosciuszko Squadron, which is legendary to this day. It was actually formed for that force from the Americans who essentially had, he had stayed in Poland as part of the war administration under Wilson, and then became involved in creating this air force, very similar to the Americans who went to Canada at the start of World War II. And they became an immensely famous fighting force that to this day they still continue the name, and of course carried the name into World War II after the fall of Poland. And he fought, according to the family, I believe something like 70 missions in a biplane against the, fighting for the White Russians on the Ukraine border against the Bolsheviks, the Battle of Warsaw, and again was shot down and was captured by the Soviets, who were probably not as kind as the Germans were. And this is a family story that is delightful. I don't know if it's true. But this one, I actually think there's more truth to it because of the source that I've heard it from. It's well known that he was shot down and escaped from that Soviet prison after approximately 9 months as an internment and a harrowing 400-mile trek with two other POWs to Latvia, where he was liberated. That part is absolutely true, and he actually later got the highest award from the Polish army. But I am more delighted by the story. I've always heard how he got out of the POW camp, which I have never seen in any of the biographies. According to my father, he had heard that Marion bribed the guards. And then, in an act of magnificent wisdom, stayed across from the prison in a square in open public because the Russian guards were not looking for someone who would actually stay visibly in their sight. And then, once cover of darkness began, the harrowing 400 miles. What becomes fun is in World War II, Marion went back and became a brigadier general, or ultimately became a brigadier general. He was Claire Chennault's chief of staff in China.
Wow.
And was administering the Flying Tigers over the hump. My father says that in World War II, he was approached by the Soviets, of course, who were our ally, who were still trying to figure out how he had gotten out of that POW camp. Because, of course, the one thing the Soviets had not conceived of was the concept of a completely capitalistic mechanism to escape from prison. And that's why I think there's a measure of truth to this story. That they, 20 years later, were still trying to figure out how he had done it because they were unable to grasp the mechanism itself. So
that's completely possible. That seems likely.
Seems is the word, because I don't know.
Yeah, I get it. I had another family member whose name was Jimmy Potter, so James Potter for Harry Potter fans out there, and he distinguished career as a naval aviator. And the challenge that we have are the family members, like my grandmother, who adored him, helped raise him. When she would tell some of the stories, I'm not sure if she was getting, like, his rank right and what his job was. It's like, okay, was he the commanding officer of Pensacola, Florida, or the XL? When he was on the Saratoga, was he the CAG, or was he the XO of the air group, or was he the XO of the ship? Because those are all different. But he had, like, 5 tours in Vietnam. He flew Sikorskis and... Sandys, the A-1s. He was an A-4 pilot. And one of the comments that he made, not to me, I did meet him a couple times, but again, according to my dad, he said he had 9 crashes and getting shot down didn't count. So it's like, so what was the number? So yeah, I get the aviator...
Mystique.
Yeah, mystique and the stories. It's right up there with sea stories from sailors that...
Yeah, the sighting of there lies monsters. You just don't... There be monsters.
We know a lot of it's true. We just don't know how much of it is exaggerated.
Exactly.
But they know we know they did a lot.
Well...
So he... Flying Tigers...
Yeah. Now I can tell you because the King Kong, because I know you've been waiting.
Yeah, no, this is fascinating to know, because the history of somebody's life explains why they do things.
Early in his, long before all the events I told you about in his youth, he had been given a book about explorations in Africa.
Okay.
In the wake of the Polish Soviet war, which ended around 1921, he also was a news writer. But he then became involved with the nascent idea of going abroad in documentary style. And I don't know if that evolved out of his news writing. I believe it did. I think he actually worked for, not the National Geographic, but like the Explorers Society in New York, and was doing pieces on going to, you know, it's still remote parts of the world in that time, which had largely still been unexplored. He became then involved with the early work in camera work. And in the course of this work, he met Ernest Schoedsack. Who would become his collaborator on King Kong. And they actually worked in some early pioneering documentary filmmaking that included going to what was then Abyssinia and meeting the future, the great Ali Selassie, getting away from pirates in outside of Yemen. All these really, truly remarkable events that because there were others there, there were ways to verify these happened. And amongst the work they did some filming for one of the early documentaries that came out called Gao the Headhunter. But most importantly, they eventually decided to work together to do one of the, what is often cited, two great examples of true documentaries in the silent era, Grass.
Okay.
And Grass, along with Nuke of the North, are primarily credited as the first examples of docudrama. But Grass went a step further. Nanook, of course, had a lot of staging. Grass actually followed the Persians going across from Turkey over the steppe to the grasslands, and is so modern that the Museum of Modern History maintains in New York a copy of it with a history behind it because of its view of this being paramount importance to the artistic development of film as a whole in the 20th century.
Wow.
And then Schoedsack and Cooper became very close, and they made a second film, Chang. Chang is set in it was set in Siam and what I think would now be Burma or Thailand. I'm not sure which of the two countries. It's more like Nanook. There is staging, it tells a story, but they also did real live action capturing of tigers and elephants, and its filming was well ahead of its time. Both of those films actually did fairly well even in the silent era and started to gain them the need that they had to have for production interest as it related to the larger Hollywood scene. At that point, they had the capital to go to RKO and get another film, The Four Feathers, which started to get them into mainline filming. As I go back, Marion had been heavily influenced by this notion of this movie of the African adventure and that, and he had a formative idea of possibly having something like a gorilla versus a Komodo dragon fight. But if you believe what he told my family and others, at around 1930, my grandfather became actively involved in the development of Pan American. He became a pioneer in air law and space law, and my grandfather became vice president general counsel of Pan Am. Marion then moves to the board as part of this, and he's also getting some amount of the funding for his film works from my grandfather, his brother. And he starts floating the idea of a mainline film. And he claims that coming out of the Chrysler Building, which is where Pan Am was at that time, he looked up and saw a plane flying around in the sky above New York and came up with the idea, wouldn't it be great to have a gorilla up there? He still was working out some of these things, like the gorilla might fight the Komodo dragons in there, but he then started to play the idea off of Edgar Wallace, who died before he could write the screenplay. Then he worked with Ernest Schoedsack's wife, who actually is not credited with script, but did a great deal of it. And they started working out the details. And then my great uncle, you know, it's better to be lucky than good, then saw Willis O'Brien's work on the Lost World, which at that time it was unparalleled in terms of its advancement in stop action, cinematography, and realized, this isn't going to be about Komodo dragons. I'm bringing in the dinosaurs. this is where things become a classic Hollywood story. So he has the formative idea of what's going to be King Kong, and they're still working through the script, but they have the idea it's going to be Jungle Island, much like what he and Ernest Schoenstatt had actually lived through near Sumatra. And the other develops start to fall in place. One of the more funny things is they then begin what is now well known in Hollywood, getting over budget and taking too long to make a movie. As it turns out, Faye Ray, who was hired for that, would make four movies between the point that she was hired and when the King Kong would fully come out. One of which is The Most Dangerous Game, in which three of the prominent players, Faye Ray, Robert Armstrong, Bruce Cavett, all actually have a pot. More importantly, if you ever see that black and white film, if it looks strange that the scenery looks a lot like Skull Island, that's not an accident. It is, in fact, the Skull Island stage.
One was day, one was night filming or something like that. Yeah.
They had to do some production in New York. They had to show the film planes taken off from the Brooklyn Air. Mm-hmm. Of course, they really couldn't put Kong on top of what was then only 1 year old, the Empire State Building. Originally, I understand the concept was Kong to be on the Chrysler Building, where Pan Am itself was, because for a brief period, it was the tallest building in the world, until just down the street, they built to every fan's delight, the Empire State Building, which serves so much better of a venue. They built the model on the sound stages and the like, and the rest is history. But it's that amalgamation of his background with Ernest Schoenstatt in a real life, going through these adventures, that you don't underestimate the importance, for instance, of that background with Chang, with Grass, mm-hmm. or even being shot down over as a fighter pilot. It's well known and it's documented to death that Marion, when they did the final production scene, said we ought to shoot the son of a bitch ourselves, and he and Schoenstatt are in the plane that shoots down Kong. A fact that was so important to Peter Jackson when they remade the movie that Jackson insisted he be in the plane that shoots down Kong. You know, an 80-year or 70-year tie between two great directors.
Wow.
The difference, though, is Marion actually flew those planes.
As opposed to the green, blue screen. And yeah. Jumping forward, when Jackson made his King Kong homage, was he in contact with your family at all? Did you guys?
He was not. In fact, it was suggested I contact him.
Okay.
Now, it really shouldn't. Marion had two daughters and a son, one of whom is a Vietnam veteran Colonel Richard Cooper. I hope, and maybe that Peter Jackson was in touch with him, who would have been a better source anyways.
Okay.
The son is definitely going to know more than the great nephew. And probably have a better sense of I hear it through the prism of various levels of family. The son would have had it directly from the parents.
I hope he did reach out, because he, again, from what I know of interviews, seems the type.
Yeah, I will tell you, I reached out to Disney when they remade Mighty Joe Young and never heard back.
Okay.
So that also discouraged me from reaching out.
Details. We'll talk about that. So, you know, we just brought up the age, you know, that this year Kong is 85 years old, and it was April was the official anniversary. Why do you think the film's so beloved 85 years later?
Because it's still the best monster that the Hollywood's ever produced. I think there is no better way than to say it. It created its own mythos.
Uh-huh.
A great example is, look at the various sources in modern movies that still give mass, not just Peter Jackson's remake. There's a wonderful scene in Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino's movie, where the Nazis all put cards on their heads to play a drinking game to guess who the character is. And Tarantino said that he viewed the movie as a metaphor for American slavery. And that's exactly how that scene plays out. The Germans are speaking in German to one another, and he goes, am I a foreigner, am I an American? And one of the Germans said, well, not by birth. He goes, am I brought to America? Am I brought in chains? Am I brought on a plane? Am I imprisoned in chains? And he goes, am I a slave? And they go, no. Then he goes, then I'm King Kong. And I later read Tarantino says that's how he views the movie. It's a metaphor for this. He says he fully appreciates it, and I agree. Marion probably never saw that. A different one that's out right now, Ready Player One, begins with a magnificent homage to Kong and his video game counterpart Donkey Kong at the very beginning, but it is still clearly King Kong, but not Donkey Kong, because in the background you see this ape on a very high Manhattan mountain is how he spies the hero before going after him. And yeah, in music, you have the line, meaner than old King Kong, and the like. It's just he's very, very loved, because I think he is the most close that a depiction of a monster has been of our internal conflicts as humans. He is a tragic hero. He clearly loves Fay Wray's character, although there is the dark question, what exactly does he want to do with Fay Wray? He goes to, you know, the classic American city, New York, and is shot down under circumstances he didn't create for himself. I know J.J. Abrams said when he was making Cloverfield that he was deeply moved when he went to Japan. He wanted to get our own kaiju. Uh-huh. And he said, we have King Kong, but he's special. I did not want it to be another King Kong. And that shows you even a director is... like J.J. Abrams understands there's something very special about Kong.
People, the effect that created him, you know, with the models and the amount of time and effort and love that went into creating him and giving him a soul, because it's a special effect. And yet people connect because that he emotes.
Exactly.
And
that's a better way than I could have just said.
You were very thoughtful, but it's the emotional connection people get, and with he goes from being the alpha creature of Skull Island, and he's kidnapped, you know, to be a vaudeville act. Like, that's not right, and he goes on his rampage, and it's not of his own doing. But he's a wild animal. He's intelligent, but he's still a wild animal. The flashbulbs have their effect on him, and they upset him, and he goes out and breaks things and kills people. And despite that, we don't blame him for it.
Yeah, Kong Skull Island, the new verse, just outright makes him heroic.
We should talk about the newer films, but I loved Skull Island. I was a little disappointed in the Godzilla 2014. I enjoyed it, but the script had some problems. Kong Skull Island, it's a condensed story. You know, they're trying to escape the island. You have, you know, Samuel Jackson's character feeling very upset about we gave up on Vietnam. And I mean, historically, I agree with that. What he does in response is wrong, because there's the old maxim with that a French general said, don't fight the last war, fight the next one. And he wanted to, I'm not going to repeat what we did in Vietnam. It's like, dude, different situation. Like, this is a giant ape. We don't belong here. We have to leave. And he's the good guy here.
Yeah, and you know, going back into the 33 film, don't forget that Kong's last act, and it's redone again in the remakes, is to put Fay Wray down on the ledge, acknowledging, I'm not going to harm you, and knowing that you presumably think that it recognizes it's about to die. So there's this very compassionate, that whatever else is about to happen, this is the sacrifice, and you are not part of it. In Kong Skull Island, it's taken one step further, in which Kong actually comes to defend those that he seems to recognize are not there to cause him harm. He actually he has his own motivations. The skull crawlers killed his family, but he is clearly motivated also to keep those skull crawlers from killing others.
Which, I look forward to the future of the legendary films, because we have the new Godzilla one coming out, and that director seems very into it. and I have a good feeling about it, but I've had good feelings before, but they seem to be on the right track. Then we'll get a Kong and Godzilla movie again, and that director seems really into it. He shut down his Twitter feed, unfortunately, because of another project and people just being schmucks on Twitter, which is unfortunate, because he shouldn't have to put up with that. But great reverence, you know, for the source material and you know, two classic monsters, Kong and Godzilla. And when Toho did King Kong versus Godzilla, that was the most successful monster movie they had ever done, and all following ones were judged by that.
You know, it's a very interesting historical fact that a lot of people don't know, that one of the very first emulations of King Kong, it's a lost film, was a 1939 Japanese make. All that's known is that it's set in Tokyo. It was obviously made under the regime that would later become, you know, who we would go to war with. But it seems to have, what little know about it, seems to still have much of the same love the Japanese would give it in the 60s. It's like, we love this idea of a giant monster rampaging through Tokyo. And I've always personally loved the ending of King Kong versus Godzilla, because Kong emerges from the water and Godzilla does not, giving just a subtle hint we might think the Japanese rooted for to win that battle. It's known that they're both not dead. But.
I've been reading an amazing biography on Ishiro Honda, who directed the first Godzilla movie and King Kong versus Godzilla and a bunch of others, and his war experience and his education and going to school. And I don't remember the other director that he met, but this other guy absolutely loved King Kong and wanted to do something similar. And it's this universal reaction to Kong specifically, but we do have a fascination with giant monster movies that we love them.
Yeah, and I think the thing that makes Kong work is, and it works for Godzilla too, to be clear, is that he evokes, you said emotes, a very human response. Like I said, Quentin Tarantino can look at it as a metaphor for slavery, but a whole different people can look at it as a metaphor for imperialism.
Uh-huh.
Another can say, you know, the negative effects of taking environmental species out of their natural environment. At the end of the day, everybody can look at it from a different metaphor. I think the best one is the one that actually is used at the end. It was Beauty Who Killed the Beast. I think even Marion would be the first to say it was meant to be a movie in some ways about misguided love. Mm-hmm. It's clear Kong does not, you know, want or Fay Wray harm throughout the entire movie. That, not sure that he likes Driscoll, but he, yeah. and you know, it's fun that Marion, it was really funny, Fay Wray to her death said, before she knew what she was getting into, Marion told her, he said, you were going to have the darkest, largest leading man in all of Hollywood, and she thought he was talking about Cary Grant. She was in for quite a surprise, but...
Gotcha.
but, you know, at the end of the day, I bet you she would take Kong over Cary Grant historically any day now.
Well, it's just the importance of the film and the way that people care about it, and that she became a cultural icon because of it. And had a, I mean, I've looked up her career. She had a really long career and did a ton of things, which is wonderful. I mean, she did some stuff beforehand, but afterwards as well.
You know, when she died, they dimmed the Empire State Building for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How many Hollywood actors can get an homage quite like that?
Yeah, not many, because it just doesn't happen. So it's fascinating knowing the your family history includes a lot of lawyers, because it appears that when we get to Son of Kong, I don't know if your granduncle was talking to his brother, which seems to be a highly likely possibility, but it notes that there were 11 lawsuits against Carl Denham, a possible grand jury indictment, so he flees the country. I mean, it's brilliant, because litigation is a major plot point that kicks off the adventure.
I think it's fair to say he had to have been talking with my brother to some degree. My grandfather, his brother, to mm-hmm. some degree. They were both on the board of Pan American Airways at that time. They were obviously in contact for professional reasons, independent of being brothers. Don't forget that Marion's father himself was a lawyer, prominent lawyer. And around this time, it was around 1931, my grandfather became the president of the Florida Bar, even. So,
oh, wow.
They had visibility. It's an easy leap to see them make that connection. As much as anything, one thing that's interesting about King Kong is it's pre-code. It's one of the last movies. It's also iconic in its own right. It becomes the very first movie of any kind to be re-released. That's something that we now take for granted, but in the 1930s, no one had ever conceived of that. And the re-releases had to cut out a lot of the content in the original 33, most notably the very famous scene where he takes Fay Wray and is playing with her. They made that very famous in the remakes as well. That scene was considered way too risque. The scene with the soldiers being thrown off the log was actually not shown in the 30s in the later remakes, even though that's now very famous. And
chewing up the guy on the street and dropping the lady out the window, those different versions. Yeah,
exactly. And the only thing that's funny is they add in the more famous scene that a lot of people now see of Kong on the more modern Empire State Building. If you take a look, something seems off. That's because in the 50s in the remake, they took a more recent shot, and it's actually in better film.
Okay.
So it looks clearer in the pictures. And it's been noted as a continuity question, but it's actually an insertion on the remakes.
Interesting.
It took all the way until the 1970s before any actual recovery could be made of the original 1933 version. I raise that because Son of Kong, if it seems more slapstick, lighthearted, it is perhaps because it was coming into the code era. He's fleeing because of the lawsuits. So what happens? He finds a treasure, of course, because that's, what you expect.
We're going to make this go away the easy way. Not through hard work, but by finding money.
Exactly.
We're gonna swindle our way out of this.
Yeah, and don't forget, this was the early Depression. So, there's a... If you catch it, one of the guys going in to see Kong says, I paid $20 to see this. By standards of the day, that would be like saying I'm paying the $1,000 ticket for the Super Bowl.
I did the math. It was their opening night box office was more than 10 grand. He said $10,000 box office, which today's money would be wildly expensive. Which is good for them. I'm like, if you could sustain something like that and have that kind of, if you can have that type of show, everyone's going to get rich. It'd be like bigger than Hamilton type show.
And all you're doing is showing a big gorilla.
For me, there's a huge conservation message, and even in Son of Kong, it has it that it's more than don't mess with nature, but it's respect it, which they really do hit hard in Mighty Joe Young.
That's correct, and Mighty Joe Young is a very classic code film. Oh, you have all the makings of how the code had affected Hollywood between 1933 and 1946. But one thing that's nice about it is it does create a rare monster movie with a happy ending.
Yeah, it's like three times the charm, because going back to Son of Kong, I remember seeing that. I kind of repressed the memory, or wasn't aware that it was Son of Kong when I saw it when I was very young. It was Creature Features, Channel 2.
I remember that.
And so it was after school. And I remember his hand above the water with the bandage on it. And that messed me up as a kid, because it was like, no, that can't be how it ends. He can't die like that. It's not right. He should get away.
I remember having almost the exact same reaction. It's like, he didn't do anything. What's the, why?
He was a good boy. He helped people. He was sweet and adorable.
And he's already lost his father.
Just watching it recently, it's like, this is wrong. It's like, he doesn't deserve that. He needed a happy ending. And Skull Island sinks and they all get screwed. It's just so bad. It's heartbreaking. But then again, we're looking at kind of like animatronic puppets that we care deeply about. And I would love an action figure of Son of Kong. And like, I haven't found one ever.
The albino Kong, yeah.
Yeah, because it's just, he's cute.
That's the intent.
It worked.
Well, yeah, it's funny you should say that because I do know Peter Jackson owns like one of the. It's apparently beat up in that, but I've seen him talk about how he owns, I think, one of the dinosaurs that was used as one of the original Willis O'Brien stop actions. And another one came up for auction a few years back, and I think went for a few hundred thousand or something. I actually don't have a clue what's happened to Son of Kong. I can tell you what happened to other parts of the stage of King Kong. It becomes the background for one of the other great movies of the 30s.
Which was?
Gone with the Wind.
Wow, that's a leap.
No, it's not. David O. Selznick was the president of RKO when King Kong was developed. He actually is the one who greenlit it.
Okay.
He then leaves. And Marion takes over as president.
Okay.
Now, David O. Selznick then runs into Marion's own well-known problem of the stories of the cost overruns of Gone with the Wind are the legend. Yeah, they've even made Turner Broadcasting did an entire documentary on the problems in the development of Gone with the Wind and how over budget it was.
Wow.
One of the ways Selznick developed a way to lower his cost was for the scene that's the Burning of Atlanta, he purchased for a percentage interest, I think Marion got a percentage, of the set for Skull Island. Okay. That is what is burning when you see the Burning of Atlanta.
Wow.
One of the most iconic sets in the history of film is going up in flame in an even more iconic movie. So when you see, next time you see Gone with the Wind, bear that in mind when you see that scene. That is Skull Island. The gate, if you look carefully, you can sort of see the background that was once Skull Island.
I don't know how I feel about that. That kind of makes me sad that they sacrificed it.
I think, you know, two great movies being connected, I think is very good. The other great connection, and I wanted to make sure you knew this, Marion, amongst his other achievements, was a real major innovator in film.
Mm-hmm.
King Kong itself is one of the very first, like, five or six movies that was scored from start to beginish by Steiner.
Okay.
Well, Steiner then goes to score Gone with the Wind, one of the most famous soundtracks you've ever heard.
Yeah.
Marion, when he was at RKO, became one of the earliest and major advocates, and he sold David O. Selznick on Technicolor. The reason Gone with the Wind is one of the first films in color is directly related to Marion's putting Selznick and quite literally selling him on the very concept of that film. Later, Marion's career was bookended by introducing Cinerama. That was his last great movie innovation. And of course, to this day, Cinerama is considered the precursor to IMAX and to, you know, widescreen formats that are just now what we take for granted. He was very, very into these technical innovations. And for that reason, that's his other tie directly to Gone with the Wind. But one funny one I've seen is Marion's wife, Dorothy Jordan, was an actress.
Okay.
She went into retirement upon their marriage right before Kong. One of the few times she came out, very briefly, she did the screen test for the character that was played by by Olivia de Havilland.
Okay.
And I have seen the screen test for it.
Oh, wow.
She would later make one last and great appearance in what I think some people might actually say is even the only film that rivals Kong that Marion was associated with in terms of importance to film history. Marion, in his later career, was John Ford's collaborator on most of the great westerns involving John Wayne, including the Cavalry Trilogy. She wore a yellow ribbon, Fort Apache, Rio Grande, The Quiet Man, and Hope. They ended their collaboration on the greatest of the films, which was The Searchers.
Okay.
Dorothy Jordan plays that is. I don't know if she ever played in another movie again, but she plays the incredibly important role of the mother of Natalie Wood, who is, of course, in that movie, killed and the implication possibly raped, and sets John Ford on his homicidal, or John Wayne on his homicidal track. That is why many filmmakers believe that's one of the, that it is almost certainly John Ford's greatest movie, and he had quite a career. And it's often cited as arguably the best Western ever made.
And there's, I listened to a podcast not too long ago that talked about influences on George Lucas, and Searchers had a big impact on Lucas as well.
I've seen the same reference.
Yeah, multiple times. That's phenomenal. There's another legend associated with Marion, and that's Ray Harryhausen.
That's correct.
Who was like the first technician for Mighty Joe Young.
Entirely true.
Love what he did with Mighty Joe Young. I mean, that ape looks beautiful. The effects different than Kong and Son of Kong, and those are beautiful. I'm not trying to take away from it, but I have a strong affinity for Harryhausen, and just knowing that they collaborated and that beautiful gorilla is wonderful to look at.
Well, from what I understand, and I actually saw an interview with Ray Harryhausen where he talked about the importance of Mighty Joe Young. Willis O'Brien was brought back to make the stop-action Mighty Joe Young, and Harryhausen was his first assistant. Mm-hmm. Harryhausen said that was the moment in his career that he decided, this is what I want to do.
Wow.
And this is how I'm going to do it. And he said it was like, the classic thing of Rodin meeting his mentor, the light. And of course, it's great to know that the torch can be handed that way. Marion also has some funny other ones. Early in his career, he did the movie, another film that he was, I can't remember, executive producer or director. It was around the same time as Kong, called Flying Down to Rio. He convinced the pairing of Ginger Roger and Fred Astaire for the first time.
Wow.
And in fact, it's the only time Ginger Rogers was listed in the bill above Fred Astaire, because he was the unknown at that point.
Oh, wow.
His probably greatest contribution is he convinced John Ford to give an unknown Catherine Hepburn her first screen test for Howard Green, and which led to How Green Was My Valet, and of course led to 4 Academy Awards as Best Actor. I'm glad to say Marion had a direct role in that. So he did have an eye for talent, if nothing else.
That was phenomenal. I mean, just what an amazing life. Now, there's pivoting to Kong. Toho did 2 Kong movies. We talked about King Kong versus Godzilla, which special place in my heart for it. They also did King Kong Escapes.
Yes.
Which, not a fan of the Kong, but I love Mecha Kong. I found one of those figures. It was super hard to find. I love that design. Did you enjoy those films as well, or is it...
Well, since I first saw them when I was like 8, of course I did. Uh-huh. And I saw them fairly close in time after they came out. Yeah, they used to show them religiously on PBS in the 70s into the 80s. I think I was put off by Kong having this ability to zap.
Yeah.
That kind of always troubled me. But they're so campy that it's impossible not to enjoy them. Although I will concede that my personal favorite, and I'm glad that it's going to be part of the next Godzilla, is Ghidra the Three-Headed Monster. I've always been a mess, and I've always been disappointed Kong didn't get a cameo in that. but I did. I agree with you with Mecha Kong or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just so funny looking.
It's. I mean, the plot of that thing is bonkers.
But every Toho film is.
You have the spy element, but you also have the optimistic future that the UN has nuclear submarines going out exploring. So like there's that optimistic view of the future of what we could do, which was nice. But then you get the weird James Bond element with Doctor Who, and being the grandson of a dentist, that's still a tough thing for me to see because I want that guy to have dental care. But it's like, dude, what happened? But I love the design of Megacon so much. I've met a couple of amazing kaiju artists, and one day I might get commissioned a Hezai Gamera slugging it out with a Mecha Kong because I just think that would look so cool.
It's almost certain at some point in the future it'll happen. Like I said, what little I know about the future Godzilla film is Ghidorah is going to be the antagonist, and I think Rodan and a couple others are going to have cameos.
Mothra's supposed to be in it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, allegedly they're going to call it King of the Monsters, but they've seemed to backtracked on that, so we'll find out. But yeah, that will be fun. I'm super excited. You know, the 7-year-old in me is ecstatic for the time period that we're living in. As to Kong with electricity, from what I've heard, and I don't know, I haven't verified it in other sources, but I've heard on a couple podcasts that they originally were going to do Frankenstein versus Godzilla, which from the War of the Gargantuas with was it Gera, since he, you know, the big green one, big brown one, you know, after fighting Frankenstein Conquers the World, he was supposed to have the electricity power. And because they had a rights issue and they couldn't do Frankenstein versus Godzilla, they went with that plot for Kong versus Godzilla, giving Kong that electrical zap, and Godzilla's suddenly allergic to electricity. But that stuff aside, it is such a fun little movie to watch.
It's funny you should say that. I do know that Willis O'Brien tried to promote in the 1930s a King Kong versus Frankenstein.
Okay.
They had both come out. I think there were problems with the studio relationships. Yeah, you talked about the lawyer relationship. Kong became its own massive intellectual property rights fight, which I understand there are still issues outstanding to this day as to what RKO had, how they had transferred it, the marionette. But there were problems that Willis O'Brien never was able to get Kong versus Frankenstein. But apparently he did some mock-ups for some of what he has planned to use in it. And years later, there are rumors that he actually used some figures that he may have developed in the 30s in a film he did in the 50s. Personally, I'm very glad that Frankenstein and King Kong did not meet in the 30s. I think it might have diminished the iconography. I mean, the Japanese had the right idea to create it into an entirely different genre.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think it would have worked in the 1930s genre.
We weren't there yet.
We weren't.
When you look at the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and, the other 1950s monster sci-fi and the march that both the United States is on and then what the Japanese create with their kaiju, because it's different. I've been reading a wonderful book about kaiju movies, and it gets into how they touch on different Japanese storytelling styles.
Oh, sure.
And how it's a blending of three different styles that's traditional and modern, and it just works. And part of it is with the majority of action at the end, and the first part could be kind of slow, but it's this massive buildup and setup.
Well, yeah, talk about how you asked why is Kong early on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as much as anything, Kong is relevant because 80 years later, it still holds up as a really modern, one of the modern film. And it has the primitive black and white, but it's so far ahead of its time. You can tell, the stop action is the most obvious, but there are other complexities, something that is now almost a trope, but the idea of it in 1933, think about it. Kong doesn't make an appearance in that movie until almost 50 minutes into the movie. Yep. That's something that, you know, in movies like Aliens to this day, we get used to this idea of the buildup. When are we going to finally see what we're truly up against? And in some movies like Cloverfield, arguably you don't even until the very end. But that itself is part of what I think works, is whether it was by design or by luck, it has a real modern feel. Uh-huh. And yeah, that's why you can remake it. That's why Peter Jackson can make almost a virtual recreation of the movie, and it still is relevant. Why Kong Skull Island, you know, you're just dying to see Kong, but they have to have the buildup of going to the island, what are we up against, until you finally see this gigantic, quite a bit larger than the ape in the original movie, decide that he's going to take out some helicopters.
Yeah, and which is, again, a beautiful homage to King Kong Escapes, because they have a helicopter assault on Kong, except there's work, because it's a plan, we're going to drop gas on him to knock him out, but he throws trees and that at the helicopters. So when you watch Kong Skull Island, it's like, did they do that on purpose, or was it just a happy accident that those two things connect?
Well, and even in Kong Skull Island, they did have a few fun nods. Mm-hmm. The skull crawlers, of course, looked similar to the famous monster that comes out of the gorge that has no hind legs.
Yeah.
But there are, like, nods in other films. One of the funnier ones, Peter Jackson, in his remake, there are Easter eggs that are very direct homages to Marion. The one that everyone picks up on is Jack Black's character asks if Fay Wray is available, and they're told that she's under production elsewhere, and he answers, Cooper, huh?
yeah, I remember.
But if you look carefully, another funny homage that is much less noticeable is that in Jack Black's office, you'll see movie posters, one of which I distinctly remember was Chang.
Okay.
And it showed Stack Cooper production, and another one may or may not have been Grass.
Okay.
You know, little details like that. And Kong Skull Island, I think, has a few others. I think there is an argument that the helicopters are an homage to the Japanese, because it's part of the monster universe that's to cross over with Toho. Obviously, Godzilla makes a cameo at the very end,
which is brilliant.
And I have no doubt Kong's going to have a similar cameo in the forthcoming movie, probably in the credits. Probably mad that somebody's done something to his island, and he's decided he's going to come do something about it.
What happens? How do they get connected? And because it's interesting, Kong and this version is clearly a hero monster.
Well, so is Godzilla.
Godzilla's like neutral to, like, he doesn't care about people. He's just there fighting the other creatures, which, you know, does that put him more like Heisei Gamera, with like he's just there to keep balance, or is it something else?
Well, I was lucky to see Godzilla because we're here, in Silicon Valley, but I saw it in San Francisco.
Which,
of course, that is the exact audience you kind of want to see that film, because everybody was having a delight. I mean, the landmarks that go down. Keep going down throughout. But there is the sense that Godzilla's like, you guys just stay out of my way. I'm going to take care of this, but your buildings, they may have to suffer a bit. But he does seem to have a motivation. Like, he seems to ignore, unlike the bad monsters, he seems to actually ignore the humans.
Yeah.
So he does seem single-minded that I'm going to get that monster, and these other things are just kind of...
He doesn't knock out the aircraft carrier. He just, and... That being said, if I were the commander in chief or the supreme allied commander trying to manage that, my reply would be, stay out of his way.
Yeah.
Okay. We don't need the destroyers here. Just pull back, let him in, stay away. We're not going to shoot at him.
Yeah, and whereas in Kong Skull Island, Kong does seem to he seems to virtually recognize, okay, these guys are good. Mm-hmm. I will help them. Samuel Jackson, on the other hand, you're mine. Yeah. And vice versa.
There's a, I haven't read it, but I've heard a really good podcasts that I listen to, they've enjoyed the comic Kong and Planet of the Apes, which I saw the poster for that and was like, you're kidding, right?
I love it.
So it's like Dr. Zaius and the general, like, they go out on some expedition and they find Skull Island. And for them, it's like a religious experience because, like, hey, this proves, like, where we came from. And then they bump into, they're the evolved humans who talk. And so like, Zaius is having an existential crisis because of what's happened. And, you know, it's like, no, we should bring them back. And, like, we'll see what hilarity ensues from that. But that's something I'm probably going to pick up on my next.
I definitely will pick up, too. I love the idea.
The other one I heard a description about was Godzilla. I think it's a trade by now of Half Century War, which starts in 54, and it follows two young Japanese guys who end up fighting Godzilla and them belonging to the organization that fights Godzilla over the 50 years. So it starts in 54. There's one issue's in the 60s. By the, you know, third issue is 1987. And it just sounds like unique storytelling because it jumps a decade each time following one guy's career taking on Godzilla. And he doesn't do a Captain Ahab reaction, that he really, no, I have a different view on this now. So, which is, sounds fascinating, that we could take all of these monster genres, be it Kong and put them in the far future in Planet of the Apes, or take a, like, different spin on Ahab and, like, and go with, have them learn not to do that and following Godzilla for 50 years.
Yeah. I love those, you know, extrapolations. I think one reason Kong has become, if anything, more sympathetic over time is he also represents a diminishing ecology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the great apes are one of the most threatened in the world, and here is a movie that was set in 33 about for all practical purposes, he and his son of Kong appear to be the last two of their species if you take the two movies.
Yeah.
And what do? We transform him into an environment completely out of his doing.
And then destroy the environment.
Yeah.
Even though I don't think Carl Denham destroys Skull Island, I think just because he takes the jewels, I don't think that causes the island to sink because there's time lapse in between. But still, it's bad.
Yeah, and there is this sense that we shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. It's really apparent in the movies.
Oh, yeah.
That we're out of our element, and what do? We drug him, bring him to the United States. The brilliant idea Carl did. What is the most irresponsible thing I could do? I'll bring him to the most populated city in the United States. and of course, a bad idea goes bad.
Which is why I felt better at the end of Mighty Joe Young, because he goes home.
Yeah.
And everybody has a change of heart. So the shyster showman who just wanted to make a quick buck realizes this was a mistake.
And he's prepared to die to save orphans.
Yeah. All that, which is, yeah, it's like, no one's going to put him down, don't worry. <It's> True still today. So, Hero Golden Retriever, like, whatever, like, they're gonna live. but that's such brilliant filmmaking because it's black and white, but then they switch to that red and black film for the fire scene.
Exactly.
It's so effective.
And you know what? Yeah, when I saw it in the early 1990s, I couldn't help but think it might have had an influence on one of the most iconic scenes in Schindler's List. There is only one scene in that movie in color, and that's when you see the young girl's red dress as it's taken away from Auschwitz.
Uh-huh.
And it's immensely effective. And I wondered, because it's sort of, it's the same color, it's done in the same sort of, you want to remember that scene because it's important, and I don't know. I have no idea. I've never heard anything that suggested it was an influence, but I do remember when I saw that in the theater, I wondered.
Yeah, and that's what, like, we're lawyers, we're not filmmakers, but we're good at analyzing things. Mm-hmm. And that's, it's a good question. Like, what influences have these movies had? It's like, we know that Peter Jackson loves this. We know that J.J. Abrams, you know, treats this with reverency. Like, what was Spielberg's reaction to it?
You've got to wonder when you're a director whose very career was originally made on horror.
Yeah. It has to, there has to be acknowledgement or an awareness, or maybe it's subconscious with some of them.
I'm fully prepared that it's just, you know, two different directors having the same idea of effective use of color in a black and white film. And you can make the same argument that Wizard of Oz may have had it.
Yeah.
I mean, because that shifts from black and white to color, and it has a real spectacular effect, even though that was a product of the filming of the time, because it started as a black and white film and went into color. But
it completely works.
And even if it doesn't, it's just wonderful that the gift is given to us to wonder.
Uh-huh.
And to, you know, and there's no reason you shouldn't use an effective technique. All artists do.
Yeah, exactly. So one last legendary question. I have a feeling you won't know the answer, but you might. Marion wore hats, and he had that look. Do they go to his kids? Do they still exist within the family? Or?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that. I would suspect, because he wore them through a great deal of his later life,
mm-hmm.
That the two daughters and son probably do have one, if they still exist at all. You know, they're felt hats, they may have long since
interior.
I don't know the answer to that. I do know Dorothy Jordan lived into the 80s.
Okay.
And in fact, we had tried one last time to meet up with her, but she was in such poor health at the time. But she did stay in touch with my family even after Marion's passing. And I wouldn't be surprised if something like that was very personal to her and she kept one.
It's one of those defining characteristics. I mean, it's like, I wear bow ties. So, like what will happen with my family?
Well, one of the things I have at home is a very meaningful to me is a picture of my grandfather, Marion, and my great-grandfather.
Oh.
It's an unpublished photo that is just nice and to have that my father gave down to me. So I know that they passed these on, and it's very possible, to the extent any of them still exist, that they exist in one family member. All I can tell you is I don't know, and it's not my family that has them, if they do.
Yeah, just one of those things I wondered. So
yeah, and believe me, I'm aware of, you know, you will see many photos of him in that hat.
Mm-hmm.
The other one to ask the same question I'd be curious about is his pipe.
Oh, okay.
He was a pipe smoker very early on, all the way to, you know, through the 60s.
Okay, that's fascinating. Well, we can't give out specifics yet, but we're supposed to be at San Francisco Comic-Con together doing Kaiju Law, and we'll expound upon legal issues with this.
Mm-hmm.
So stay tuned for more. And Monty, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for taking the time.
Everyone, thank you very much.